Welcome to Alumni Live, the podcast. These are conversations with Grand Valley State University film and video graduates about the industry, the film video major, and alumni profiles.
Welcome to another episode of Alumni Live, the podcast. I'm Mary Graff Ashley. I graduated in 1997. I work as a film editor in Los Angeles. Today, I'm talking with Mike Petrowski, a production sound mixer for feature films and television, a member of the Cinema Audio Society as well. He's worked with filmmakers like Michael Bay, J.J. Abrams, Ron Howard, many more since starting in the industry in the mid-1990s. Some of the productions you've been on are Star Trek 2009, Straight Outta Compton, Guardians of the Galaxy, Jack Reacher, WandaVision, Westworld, Arrested Development, Transformers. Just such an impressive resume. Can you talk about your career path, what got you started, and what you're doing now, what you love about your work?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. Great to see you again, Mary.
You too.
You and I were in film school together back in the mid-90s at Grand Valley, and our paths kind of mirrored each other as we came out here to LA and started working in the business. I wasn't really a sound person at Grand Valley as far as the film department goes. I was mainly directing and editing and that kind of stuff there. I got my bachelor's in 94 from Grand Valley. And then came out here to LA, worked a little bit in post at a trailer house as a production assistant, and then missed Grand Valley and missed my girlfriend back there. Worked on my master's for a couple years and got that in 97, master's communications from Grand Valley. And that summer of 97, there was a film shooting in Grand Rapids called A Postmark Paradise that were hiring people. And they already had a director, they already had an editor, so when I interviewed, they're like, well, what else are you interested in? And I did do a lot of sound reinforcement and recording of bands and playback for bands, that kind of stuff, while I was in college as well. So I said, I'll do sound. I ended up as the sound guy for the movie, brought on my friend Matt Mulder from Grand Valley as well, because he had the equipment. So he was the sound mixer and I was the boom operator. And we liked doing it. So I moved down to North Carolina after that movie. And quickly was hired on a movie down there to do the same thing. Brought Matt down with me. And that started a few years of living in Wilmington, North Carolina, doing sound booming on movies down and TV shows down there. It was back when Dawson's Creek first started out. Did a lot of work for Dawson's Creek in those days. And then movies like Summer Catch. And then the movie Radio, which was shot in South Carolina. That's the movie I met my wife on, who was the director's assistant.
Nice.
After that movie, she talked me into moving back out here to Los Angeles. And so in 2002, I guess it was, I ended up moving back out here to Los Angeles with her and got married about a year later. And I kind of got lucky. Seriously, this business is relationships that you build and you work with and just build upon throughout your career. Glenn True, who runs True Audio, which is like the premier audio shop in the world nowadays for film production sound. He's really well known and has a lot of friends in the business. He mixed a TV series in Wilmington, and I was his boom operator on it. He liked my work ethic and my attitude. And when I moved out here to LA, he hooked me up with Peter Devlin. He'd done Bad Boys 1 and 2 and Pearl Harbor and a bunch of Michael Bay movies, and he was a very good sound mixer, and he hooked me up with him. That kind of got me doing those movies that you were just talking about, you know, the Transformers and the National Treasures and the big movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of owe a lot of that to, you know, the networking I put in when I first got down to Wilmington. That's kind of what this business is all about, networking and doing a good job and getting your next gig, making sure that you keep up those good relationships.
Yeah, and those big blockbuster movies are really huge on the sound design. Did you find that those projects were like a different beast than some movies you've been on?
Yeah, somewhat. The smaller movies, like that first one, Postmark Paradise, you know, there was a two-man sound team on set, me and Matt. Matter of fact, we only had one boom mic and one wireless microphone for a small movie like that. But we made it work. You know, we made it work, and it's much more forgiving on a smaller budget movie to be able to say, well, we can't really do a big wide shot with eight people. We can't really hear everybody. But if we do it in coverage or whatever, and we only have these amount of mics, they're a lot more open to letting you do that. Whereas on the bigger production movies, if you have 10 people talking in a scene, you got to have 10 wireless mics on all of them and make sure you have plant mics to plant around and a couple booms. Sometimes I've had up to 3 boom operators working on sets with me just to cover the whole scene and all the different people talking. A lot more prep work goes into the larger movies for sure. But in all of them, you have to collaborate with every department, you know, whether it be camera, wardrobe, grip and electric, making sure that the ballast for the lights is not too close to set. If you're shooting in a small room, you want to make sure that ballast, which has a little buzz to it, is outside the room. You can put the light fixture in the room, but the actual ballast for it that powers the light has to be outside the room because it's going to have a little buzz that would be on the microphone if it was in the room with it. And that goes for any size movie.
Do you have a checklist of things you think about before each production?
Absolutely. When I interview for a job, I'll read the script, think about how I'm going to approach each scene and how many people I think I'm going to need for my department, you know, budget-wise, how much money they have for our department for a particular movie or whatever. I'll say, well, I'm going to need a Pro Tools guy for the playback, or I'm going to need an extra boom operator for these big scenes where we have a dozen people, like that movie Jazz Man's Blues. There were scenes where we had like a dozen people doing dialogue in some of those scenes. That's why I had the 2 boom operators. And luckily, they gave me, for the whole run of the show, I had 2 boom ops and 2 utilities. And then I think for maybe half the show, I probably had the Pro Tools operator as well. So that was the largest crew I had for a show. But yeah, you just kind of read the script. You come up with what you need and you put together your crew and how many mics. For that Jazz Man's Blues movie, I knew I was going to need to buy a bigger recorder, because we were doing all the music recording and all the actors talking and everything. At the time, I only had an 8-channel recorder. So I went out and I had to buy a new recorder and sound mixer for that, a 16-channel recorder. Actually, it was 32-channel, but I only used 16. And I used every bit of it for quite a bit of that movie.
Wow. In terms of gear and what you've talked about already, can you talk about each of the roles in the sound department? Like the names and the hierarchy. I know you just mentioned a few, but are there other props you need on set, other utilities in addition to what you were just discussing? And then I also want to add, doing the boom operator position, you obviously need a lot of arm strength for that. So just wondered if you could talk about all those different areas you guys have to take part in.
Yeah, of course. Sound department is usually a 3-person sound team these days. You know, it can be larger if need be, like I said before. But the main positions are the sound mixer, production sound mixer, who is responsible for recording all of the dialogue and anything on set. And you do a mixed track of that, and then you do ISO tracks of each microphone you have out there, whether it be 1 or 2 booms, some plant mics, and lavalier body mics, transmitters that you have on the actors. And then the other job on set would be the sound utility, which is kind of like the glue of the department. They take care of both the boom operator and the production sound mixer. They make sure that everything's set up for them to do their jobs. A lot of sound mixers will show up and expect the utility to have the cart taken off the sound trailer and put onto set, and not necessarily set up as far as getting ready to roll, but at least in the right position and getting the wires ready to wire the actors, getting the comms out for the director and all the producers to listen. And then they have to deal with sound dampening, making sure that the carpets are laid down on highly reflective floors, turning off refrigerators, that kind of stuff. And then you have the boom operator, who is responsible for getting the boom in position over the actors, under the actors, wherever the best spot for the mic might be for that scene. That's kind of where I started in the business, as a boom operator. I did that for maybe a good 10 years or so before I really started mixing. And it's a great place to start. For me, it was anyway. It got me understanding all the different parts of the filmmaking experience, from the camera and the lenses. You have to know what lens every camera's on and what the frame lines are. And then you also have to know about the lighting, where the lights are coming from, the hard lights. You want to stay out of those so you don't get shadows. And like you say, yeah, it is a kind of a physical job where you're holding your hands up over your head with a boom, with sometimes a heavy mic out on the end. for hours on end every day. But back when I first started booming, I was much younger. I was in my 20s, and I did a lot of kayaking back in those days to keep in shape. It was just fun, and I loved doing it. But it was also great for keeping my shoulders built up and giving me the right stamina for being able to stand like this for 12 hours a day. Like I say, the biggest sound department I've had on a movie was a movie called The Jazz Man's Blues. It was a movie about a jazz singer in the South back in the 1930s or so. And it was a music-heavy production. I was a sound mixer on it. We'd record them actually singing the stuff on set. And then after we'd do a take or two of that they liked, we would play it back with the Pro Tools guy. And then we had two booms, and then we had two utilities, because one of them had to deal with wiring up all the actors for us. And then the other one dealt with helping me set up everything else with the Pro Tools app and comms to the director and all that kind of stuff. It can get pretty busy for just a 2-3 man sound team on something like that. So you kind of negotiate early on to get yourself the right people that you need for each production.
That's amazing. Why else is sound important for a movie? Like, how does it help tell the story in other ways? Or if you have other projects where it was a period piece, are there other old materials you would use to capture sound for those?
Yeah, I think what makes sound so interesting for movies is that it gives you the natural performance. And why I like production sound versus, you know, throwing a bunch of ADR in a movie or whatever. It's one of the reasons I like doing Michael Bay movies is 99% of it is production sound. He hates the sound of ADR, and he wants the actual performance from the actors on set while they're recording. And I know some actors will say, oh, I love doing ADR and I can get that same performance, but it's not the same. You know, it's a different microphone. Like this mic right here is the same mic I use on all my movies and the one you got right there. And it's in the atmosphere, the room, the settings of where you're actually filming the scene, and it gives it that authenticity that you really don't get in ADR. You know, ADR is going to be in a booth 6 months down the line. The actor's been in one or two other productions since then, and it's totally, you know, you can watch it and say, oh yeah, I remember, and I can do it like this. But to capture that performance the initial time and be able to give it the authenticity that the director was looking for, I think is key to making the viewer seem like they're actually watching the authentic version of it. You know what I mean?
Makes perfect sense.
It doesn't seem like a performance. It seems like reality. You know, like you're capturing the essence of what the director and the actor were going for. On the movie Ambulance, which I mixed a few years back, a Michael Bay movie, where he'll give out lines. And when I was a boom op on a lot of his movies in the day, I would follow him around on set because he will hand out dialogue to people without telling anybody, just extras even. You know, he'll go up to somebody and he's like a real air traffic controller or something when we're shooting in like a booth or something, and he'll be like, oh, what would you say here? And he'll say, you know, I would say this usually. And he goes, all right, that's great. Yeah, say that. And he won't tell anybody. So you got to make sure that you're close enough to hear him to put a mic on somebody that will say something just out of the blue. I remember an Ambulance I was mixing, and my boom op missed one of those. And it was like a cop coming up to the back of an ambulance and saying something to the people in the back of the ambulance. And it wasn't even an actor. He was a day player that was there and was a real cop. And he went up, he said it. And we ended up getting a wild track of it because we didn't have it mic'd at the time. And I'm like, oh, we got to get that. And we did a wild track of it and everything. And I made notes in my sound report. Unfortunately, in the final edit of the movie, they didn't add that wild track. So you kind of hear the line delivered off camera. I wish they would have added that, but...
Frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. I mean, they're under pressure too, and I'm sure they had a limited amount of time to do it all, and maybe they just couldn't find it, but...
So then when you watch films now for enjoyment, do you find yourself hyper aware of the sound, or are you able to get absorbed in the story?
That's a good question. When I was younger, I probably was more critical, you know, and like, how'd they do that? Or nowadays, I can probably get away with just enjoying a story in a movie. And unless it's something that brings me out of it, you know, and like there's some issue. I don't remember what it was. Something I was watching last week. I just noticed I'm like, there's something off. You know, it took me a second to realize, oh, I know what it is. They didn't quite do this the way that I think that would have made it sound better or made it more real. But I try not to be critical of stuff I watch because I wasn't there. I don't know what challenges any sound department was up against or whatever department I might be critical of. I just try and appreciate the movie for what it is. I would say for the most part, most people do a pretty great job.
Hey, it's Randy. We're taking a short break to tell you about the Morse Cuppy Film, Video, and Animation Study Abroad Endowed Scholarship. The scholarship was established by Bill Cuppy with support from Deanna Morse to help film, video, and animation students with the cost of studying abroad. Alumnus Bill Cuppy talks about why he started the scholarship.
We created this scholarship because experiencing the world and other cultures has been life-changing for us, and we wanted students to have a similar experience during this pivotal time in their lives.
Caroline Hamilton, the 2024 recipient of that scholarship, describes the benefits of the support she received.
I'm a film video major and I have a German minor. I've been studying German for about 8 years now. And so I decided to study abroad this past summer in Germany. It definitely challenged me as a person. I had to figure out how to do things and communicate and just put me out of my comfort zone. It introduces you to new things that you'd be afraid to experience because you don't want to embarrass yourself, but you have to just go for it. The scholarship itself, just the almost permission to be like, yes, go experience this, go learn, go see what happens, how this changes how you see the world and how you approach your work. It took the pressure off of me a little bit to just be like, I can experience this and not have to worry about everything else going on. I can just go enjoy my time there and see what I can learn and grow from.
For more information and to donate to the scholarship, visit the link in the description. Now back to the show.
You've filmed in so many different locations, Los Angeles, right? Atlanta, North Carolina, Traverse City. Did any of the different locations in certain ways or the differences in the crew change your work style?
I mean, not my style necessarily, but definitely the thing, it does change when you go to different locations. Like on Haunted Mansion, I did the reshoots for about a month on that. And we were in Atlanta for 3 weeks and then New Orleans for a week. And Atlanta was great. It was actually a utility I've worked with a bunch that I worked with there. My boom operator was a friend of mine from here, Renee, that he went out there and boomed both New Orleans and Atlanta for me. But they wanted me to hire a local utility in both places. So I used a local utility in Atlanta, who was awesome. I worked with him a bunch. But then in New Orleans, everybody, they were so busy at that time. Everybody was busy and I had to hire a new kid and we tried to train him and everything. And it wasn't his work that was bad. His work was, it was fine. You know, it was what we expected, but there was an issue with a microphone being really noisy. And I'm like, hey, we got to get in there. We got to fix that. And his attitude coming back to me was just so aggressive. I'm like, well, I'm not criticizing you. I'm just letting you know that you have to make adjustments from take to take. Makeup goes in there and adjusts the makeup in between takes. Camera will adjust things. Sound, we have to adjust things between takes too. You know, sometimes the mic will get pulled or whatever. And I'm trying to explain that to him. And he was just giving me a bit of an attitude about it. And my advice, I guess, for younger people would be just have the attitude of always wanting to learn. That's, I think, what has helped me in my career. I go into every situation trying to learn something from every situation and from everybody on set. I've learned stuff from people that have a fraction of the experience that I do on a film set, and they come up with a creative way to do something that I'm like, that is perfect. I think that is awesome. I'm going to adopt that in my wiring of a tie from now on. There are different ways to capture great audio, and I'm not poo-pooing everybody's idea that's not mine. You know, if it's a good idea and it works, I'll try that too. I mean, granted, I have a way that I do things that have seemed to have worked for me in my career, but I don't object to learning new tricks, definitely. And having a great attitude is the key. You have to have a good attitude, and you have to be able to work with different people, especially in your department, but every department on set. You have to work as a community together in order to make the vision of the director come to fruition.
Yeah, I love real positive collaboration when it's not about ego. It's about, let's do the best project here, remove ourselves, and do the best work we can do here.
Absolutely.
That's the best experiences.
And the worst experiences on a set are usually because of an ego, whether it be an actor, a director, a producer, other crew members, camera, not to throw anybody under the bus, but the biggest movies that I've done, like the Transformers and the National Treasures and Guardians of the Galaxy, those kind of things, the key aspect of almost all of those movies is everybody in creative and positions of operator and DP and directors even, minus a couple maybe. I won't name names, but it's a collaborative effort. And they're all just positive people. You know, I mean, happy to work with you. The kind of people that are willing to help other departments because they all know that we're all there for the same reason. There shouldn't be an argument between camera and sound, which is kind of like a joke on set always, you know, oh, camera and sound, they're always fighting each other. But for the most part, we always get along great and we work together to make it as good for them as it is for us. That's a collaborative effort.
And it makes the day shorter if you get what you need.
Well, shorter and just a better product. I mean, when a movie looks good and sounds good, you don't notice it. You don't notice it's a movie. But if something's out of focus or camera's just off or the sound is off and you can't really hear what people are saying, it takes you out of that experience of the director telling a story. When you work together and everything is seamless, it just takes you straight to that story and you don't even think about it being a movie. You just think about it being a story.
Yes. I want to go back to the beginning when you talked about us knowing each other in the 90s, because we met, I think, through the group of friends working on the Grand Valley radio station then, WCKS at the time.
Yeah.
Now I think they're called The Whale. And I hadn't really thought about that when we talked about doing this discussion, but I mean, that's all sound that we're putting on the airwaves. So do you think that experience enhanced any of your work or anything else at Grand Valley that shaped your career?
Absolutely. I think working at the radio station and being one of the key people getting it going early on with Dano and Pax and you and everybody else there, I also worked with Dano at special events. We did all the sound reinforcement for the concerts and things that would come to school.
Right.
So that was where my sound experience lied. It was doing all that sound reinforcement stuff. So it gave me an understanding of mic placements and recording good audio and making sure everything sounded good. But then I was also taking film classes and learning about film and theory and production and all of that. I think for me, it helped bring it all together once I got out of school and I was able to merge all of it. And that's how I kind of succeeded, I guess, at doing sound. And it snowballed into like a 30-year career now. And I definitely thank Grand Valley, whether it be the radio station and friends like you and Dano and my boss at Grand Valley, special events, Dan Seeley. He taught me a lot about sound back in those days, which I use those principles today. And then from all my teachers and professors there at Grand Valley, Barb Ruse and Gerb Efsting and Scott, they taught me a lot of how to apply the stuff I would learn in class to productions and just building on all of that. And what Dan taught me definitely got me to where I am today, and I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, Dan Seeley. I remember them setting up for all the events.
Yeah, that was us. It was me and Brian and Dano and Dan and Pete and even Paul.
Do you have advice for current students in the things that they'll do at Grand Valley and just what should they think about if they wanted to go into a career in sound?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if sound is something that somebody is interested in and for production sound, I do think sound is something that is going to be, you know, with technology changing so much, I think sound recording is still very important. When you and I first started doing this, everything was shot on film and now everything's shot on digital cameras. And even I did a documentary last month where I was the only crew member. There was a director, there was a producer, and there were two actors, and there was me, the sound guy. And everybody was on camera but me. I was the behind-the-camera person, but they shot it all on an iPhone. They would sit there and record everything with an iPhone, but I had everybody wired up, and then I would boom as well. And so as technology advances and people are using even just an iPhone, it looks incredible. It looks better than anything that we had 30 years ago. And to be able to have that technology in your pocket and to be able to create and tell your stories that way is amazing. But to tie that back into sound, you can record sound on that and it'll be fine. But they wanted professional sound, so they had me there. I had to wire up everybody in that way for post. They have all the ISO tracks of everybody. So sound is still very important with technology, the way it's changing. Everything will become easier, I think, and more user-friendly. but you're always going to have to have an understanding of the technical aspects of sound, whether it be just the technology that you're recording with or how you're working with the new iPhones and everything, because it'll say an iPhone will record at, they're like, yeah, it's true 24, but it's not. There's 23.9. You know, there are all these different frame rates and everything that you have to deal with, and you have to make sure that you're recording everything correctly. So just know your technical abilities and what you can do to make it easier for post. I guess that's our main objective as a sound mixer, is to make things easier for post to tell the story.
Amen.
That's our job on set, I think, as the sound department, is we answer to the post people, because if we didn't get it, then they have to try and recreate it. And that is never easy.
Very true. In terms of gear and what you've talked about already, what do you need in general, and how do you stay current with all the changes in technology?
Yeah, you have to stay up to date. Technology changes so much year to year when it comes to audio equipment, even cameras. When I first started doing this in the 90s, we were still recording on reel-to-reel tape, you know, Nagras. And the first few movies I did were Nagras and on tape, and then we moved over to digital recorders, which would record on an internal, but you would also send in a CD, like a burned DVD to production. And now, for the past probably 15 years or so, we've probably been just doing sending in CF or SD cards. You just burn everything to a little card and turn that into production. It changes every year as to what is the new technology. And wireless microphones have changed so much over the course of my career. When I first started in the mid-90s doing sound for movies, the transmitter packs were probably a good maybe 4 inches and maybe like 3/4 of an inch wide. Everything was bigger back then. They had these huge antennas coming off them back in those days, and they were only set to one frequency that you would be able to transmit to. And there are a lot of frequencies out there that don't work everywhere, you know, so you would have to have a bunch of them. One frequency might work in one part of town. You go to another part of town and it's closer to a radio station or a TV station over there, and it interferes with it. So you need to have choices. Whereas nowadays, the transmitters can be as small as 2-3 inches long at the longest and 1/2 inch wide. Every year there'll be trade shows that we'll go to, and we'll check out the new stuff that's coming for the next year. And it's impressive. I mean, like I say, when I first started, your wireless transmitters that you put on an actor to transmit the sound back to you wirelessly, back then the transmitters were only for one frequency. Nowadays, you can have hundreds of frequencies on one transmitter. The technology changes so quickly that every year you have to go to your trade shows and see what you need to have for the next production. And then, of course, with AI and sound cleaning applications, like Cedar was one of the first big AI tools that we would use to get rid of background noise. And they would do that for on set. Actually, you can buy a Cedar little mini computer that you would plug in, run your sound through, and it would isolate the voice and cut down all the background noise for you. You know, take out the frequencies that you don't want on there. Nowadays, that's not used as much anymore. Nowadays, it's more post, you just kind of record it. They do have noise reduction on the newer recorders, and we'll do a little bit of that, but in post, they can fix so much nowadays. It's actually incredible.
Yeah, I know with post-production, I know you can search for things with AI and just have the whole thing transcribed immediately and all those kinds of things with AI. So then with the industry now, there's been so many changes, especially in the last few years. Do you want to comment on the strikes and post-strikes and the work now and how anybody you know is navigating the changes in the industry?
Yeah, the last strikes for the actors was a lot about AI. And I totally get it. I'm on their side, you know, the actors. Matter of fact, just before that, I was doing a movie called Haunted Mansion, and all the background extras that were dressed up as all the ghosts and everything for the big scenes, in between setups, they would take those guys out and they would put them in the scanner and they would do a full body scan of all these people so they could have their likeness to put into AI and use them however they wanted in some of the scenes. And then the SAG people during the contracts were like, well, that's the kind of stuff we want to be compensated. If you're going to do that, that's great. At least compensate us for it. Don't pay a background extra for one day and then use that likeness of them forever in any way you want.
Right. And having permission would be key.
Exactly. I mean, it's one thing to be able to do it. Yeah, that's great technology. You can. But you also want to be able to compensate people for using their name, image, or likeness.
100%.
And that goes for voice as well as picture. I mean, I heard that James Earl Jones did a whole bunch of voice recordings before he passed away, so they could use it for future Darth Vader stuff in Star Wars. But I'm sure he got compensated for that. Things have changed quite a bit. From the time I got out of Grand Valley in the mid to late 90s till the strikes of a couple years ago, the SAG and writer's strike, I turned down more work than I would actually work on. I never had to do anything other than sound for film. And then when the strikes happened, studios kind of stepped back, changed the way that they produce stuff. So they started shooting things overseas and not taking us with them anymore, you know? I've been all over the world doing movies in the past, but now my friends that are producers who are budgeting these movies are being told from the studios, don't budget for Los Angeles crew anymore. They're only budgeting for local crews when they go and shoot things in other countries. Matter of fact, they're not even taking them sometimes. They'll make a line producer budget a movie they're going to shoot in Romania, budget it here in LA for shooting over there. And they don't even take those producers with them anymore. They just, all right, well, you did your 6 weeks on the show. You're done. We're going to go shoot it over there with everybody over there. But that's not to say that the future still can't be bright, because I still think that storytelling, you know, people have told stories for forever. Nowadays, it's so much easier for people to tell stories with iPhones and with digital cameras, the DJIs, all these small cameras and GoPros. And it's so much easier nowadays to do it than when we started out and you needed film stock and film cameras and all the costs of that. Nowadays, you can do it much cheaper. You can edit on your computers. I think it's a bright future for anybody that has a story to tell. Tell your story. Learn your craft of how to capture it with whatever medium you're using, whether it be even an iPhone or a digital camera or whatever. And of course, good sound. And those of us that want to be technical, there's still a future there too. I mean, I know a lot of camera people who have gotten into drone work and are doing a lot of drone work now. The movie Ambulance, I don't know if you guys have seen that, but the drone work for that movie is amazing. I mean, we had these kids. I mean, they looked like kids. They were our drone people for the movie. They were professional drone racers. They wear these goggles, and then the drones that they have go super fast, and they usually race through obstacle courses. But now we had them racing through car chases through downtown and under bridges. And
wow.
Matter of fact, there was a car jump in one of the scenes where this car jumps up, and the drone goes underneath the car. There's so much new technology that can be incorporated into telling stories, into making great movies, whether it be camera, sound, whatever department you might want to get into. I do think the future is bright with all the new technology. Of course, the big worry is it's going to take away everybody's jobs. But I think if you find your niche and find a way to help tell your director's story or your story, if it's yours, I think the future can be very bright.
I think they'll always need humans to smooth all the rough edges out somewhat.
Absolutely.
Well, this was a great conversation, Mike. Thanks for coming on the podcast, and good luck with everything.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to GVSU's Alumni Live.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Alumni Live, the podcast. Subscribe to our podcast to hear more from our alumni across the industry. Check out Alumni Live on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube for more conversations and networking. Let us know what topics you want to hear our alumni talk about. The Grand Valley State University Film Video Alumni Network is here for you, and we're glad that you're here. Thank you for listening.